Welcome to the Recess Room Podcast.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, fire!
So hi, and welcome back to the Recess Room Podcast. I'm Simon Lang.
I'm Rob Fenwick.
And I'm James Yates.
And tonight, we're going to be talking about ultrasound in cardiac arrest.
Indeed, it is a James Yates masterclass in ultrasound and cardiac arrest. I cannot wait. Obviously, there's been a massive build-up on social media, so I cannot wait to get stuck into this. I'm sat here ready to learn, my friend.
I am just the glue to stick you two geniuses together, so don't worry, you know.
That's very generous. What a generous glue you are, my friend. You might want to put a roll of tape around that as well.
Talking about glue, we've just had a fascinating discussion about how to fix some holes in plasterboards with glue and the technique that James has employed in it. So, never know, we might come back to that in a different episode or even tag it on at the end. Just learn an awful lot already.
I'm not getting involved in that.
Before we get started, a huge thanks to SJTRM, the Scandinavian Journal of Trauma, Resuscitation and Emergency Medicine, who are a free open access journal publishing articles on all the sorts of things that we cover here on The Recess Room. Go over and have a look at their website on the hyperlink on our site to check out all of their great free work. So without further ado, let's crack on with the podcast.
So as we alluded to in the initial introduction, we are looking today at ultrasound in cardiac arrest. And this is definitely a subject which has got a huge amount of traction over the last few years in the literature and actually in clinical practice as well. And this is both in hospital and also pre-hospitally. So I believe there might be a man in the room who is set up perfectly positioned to give us a bit of an introduction into some of the technical elements and just a little bit around what ultrasound actually is before we go on to the meat of the discussion.
Why, thank you, Rob. I'll give it my best shot. So, I mean, I think it's worth tipping our hat to the fact that I imagine there's probably going to be some folk listening to the podcast today that are using ultrasound all the time. And for others of you, this may be totally new and something that's really interesting to hear about. So I think we should probably try and level the playing field and give a little introduction to what ultrasound is before we kind of get into the meat of why we're keen on the idea of ultrasound in cardiac arrest. So I think over the last few years, as Rob has alluded to there, both in pre-hospital and emergency medicine in hospital practice, ultrasound has become a really increasingly popular imaging modality. And I think that's for a lot of reasons, certainly for pre-hospital care. I think the technology that underpins these ultrasound devices has been getting better and better. And that means that the products are lighter, they're more robust, they've got better battery life, and they're smaller. And that means that we can now take this imaging technology that was previously just an in-hospital device and we can bring it into the pre-hospital arena. And that's really, really powerful. And we like things that are versatile, don't we, in pre-hospital care. We hate carrying around things that only function to do one thing. It's great to have a device that can do heaps of things. And an ultrasound is that, you know, we can use it to look at lungs. We can use it to investigate abdomens and nervous tissue and vascular tissue. So it's a really, really excellent, versatile piece of kit.
Plus, don't forget, James, I mean, the other thing is about it, it's quite cool, isn't it? And it's always nice to have a new bit of technology. So let's not forget about that, you know.
It is nice to pull out a toy every now and again, isn't it? I mean, everybody enjoys a toy. But I think the one really amazing thing that makes ultrasound stand out for me is that previously, whether you're in hospital or pre-hospital, our assessment of patients has been wholly based upon taking a history and examining the patient from an external perspective and then kind of trying to work out what's going on internally. And that can be really, really tricky at times, can't it? But now with ultrasound, you know, at the side of the road in someone's house or in the emergency department, you can actually see inside the patient. And not just that, it's not just like an x-ray. We're not seeing just a flat picture. This is real time physiology in action. We can see the anatomy. We can see the physiology. We can see stuff happening.
Oh, back to that physiology yet again.
Broken record.
Let it go.
I know. But it is great. Physiology underpins everything. And we can actually see it by putting an ultrasound probe onto these patients. And that's what makes it so powerful, I think, anyway. So anyway, enough about raving about ultrasound. We'll try and give a relatively unbiased view throughout this podcast, I hope.
There's going to have to be quite a lot of negative to balance that out. I am with you. There's a lot of positives to ultrasound, isn't there? And like you're saying about the, you know, about actually getting a view inside that body, not only at that moment in time, but also, you know, looking for a response to the medical treatments that you're providing for that patient, isn't it? It's so different to how we were practicing 10, 15 years ago. So, yeah, keen to hear more.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And the final kind of cool thing about it is that it's safe as well. You know, it's not like x-rays, it's not CT scans, there's no ionizing radiation involved. This is just sound waves going into the body. So super safe as well. So great bit of kit. But anyway, onto the kit itself. If you've never come across this before, let's have a quick familiarization with what we're talking about. So an ultrasound device really consists of two main parts, the transducer probe, which is the bit that goes onto the patient, and the central processing unit. That's the kind of section with the screen and all of the keys and the functionality and the keyboard if you're using it in hospital and so on. So let's focus really on that transducer, because that's kind of where the magic happens, and it is pretty incredible. So in the end of the transducer are thousands and thousands of these things called piezoelectric crystals. And these little guys, when they get an electronic impulse across them, vibrate at a really, really high frequency. And as they vibrate, they send out sound waves, unsurprisingly, ultrasonic sound waves, which are really, really very high pitched. They're above the pitch that we can hear, the audible sound level. And those sound waves penetrate into the body. Now, the way I kind of think about this, and this is maybe a little odd, but imagine you're holding onto a bat.
Simon, you got that, mate?
Oh, just thinking about what a painful edit this podcast is going to be to actually get down to the good stuff.
I know.
I'm old enough. I've got my imaginary bat, James. You carry on, mate. I've got it.
Okay, good man. Well, it's all right. It's all right, Simon. You can just mute my entire audio feed and you can have the rest of the podcast. It'll be fine. So you've got this bat. And when I say bat, I'm not talking about like a tennis bat or a cricket bat or something. You know, this is one of the bats that flies around at night.
Is it a lively bat or is it subdued?
I thought you were going to say, is it live? It is live. That's quite essential.
Okay, but it's subdued, and so it's not wriggling. Okay.
Oh, just let him get on with it.
So hold the bat tight around the wings, just so that, you know, a friendly squeeze. We don't want to hurt it. Anyway, get his little furry face and put that...
I'm sending out ultrasound.
Put that furry face onto the patient. Okay, the bat's not going to like that too much. It's going to start squeaking, but it's squeaking and it's sending out ultrasonic sounds. It's sending out its echolocation. And that, my friends, is ultrasonography in a picture.
That's awesome. Okay, I get you.
Okay, so, I mean, hopefully you've got the picture. So basically, these ultrasonic waves come out of the bat or the transducer, and they go into the body. And then those waves can do a number of different things. But what we're kind of interested in is the waves that get reflected back from the tissue back to the transducer. And the transducer is super, super clever. And it can work out from the amount of waves that come back and the length of time it takes to come back to the transducer, how dense the tissue is that the sound waves have interacted with, and how far away that tissue was. And what happens then is that some clever computery jiggery pokery happens, and on your screen you get a slightly underwhelming black and white and grey two-dimensional picture, which you then have to interpret. And probably worth saying, despite all of my enthusiasm and excitement, that is one of the drawbacks of ultrasonography, is that you really do have to have quite a good familiarity with analyzing and assessing the screens and the images you're getting back, because it's quite a weird picture the first time you see one.
You mentioned about obviously the shading or the different colors, so, you know, the grays, whites, black. What do they actually indicate?
Yeah, so mate, that's a good question. So like I say, it's all really down to the density of the tissue that's involved. So for example, if we imagine a bone, so if we're scanning above a bony surface, that's really dense. And so a lot of the sound waves coming out of the transducer are bounced back to the transducer. And so you get a very bright white image. So dense is white. And then if we go the kind of the other end and we think about something like fluid or blood, that's much less dense in comparison to bone. And so a lot of the ultrasound waves pass through that fluid. And so you then don't get the sound waves reflected back and you get a blacker area on the screen. And then anything in between those densities then becomes on the grey scale. And that's sort of where your finesse comes, I suppose, on assessing the image. Now, that, for those of you who use ultrasound, I accept is a very kind of superficial view of how an ultrasound image appears, because the sound waves can do all sorts of exciting things, like refract away and get absorbed by things and bounce at funny directions off different tissue interfaces. But in the main, if we try and think of bright images being dense and dark images being less dense, that's probably the easiest way to interpret an image.
Okay, no, I get that, mate. That's a good summary. Thank you. What about those probes? So obviously, there's different probe choices that you can have out there. Obviously, it depends on different factors. But which ones are you commonly using in your practice, particularly for cardiac arrest, which is obviously what we're covering today?
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Rob. So there's a few different types of probe that you're going to come across. Generally, there's only about three, so not massively confusing. But each one of them has got sort of specific interventions and views and parts of the body that it's best for. So let's whiz through those quickly, and then we're pretty much at the end of my summary introduction to ultrasound. So the first of the probes then is a linear probe. Now, as it sounds, this is a very thin, straight beam of sound that comes out from a transducer that looks as that sounds, very long and thin. And the sound waves that come out of a linear probe are really, really high frequency. And what that means is that you get great resolution, really, really clear image on the screen. But those sound waves don't penetrate that deeply into the tissues. And so what the linear probes are good for is things like vascular access, nerve blocks, and looking at sort of superficial lung tissue when we're thinking about assessing for pneumothoraces. So pathology or anatomy that's only sort of 3-4 centimeters below the surface of the skin.
So good picture, but pretty superficial in summary for your linear probes, which are those little like 2-inch long, flat and thin ones, aren't they, I guess?
Yeah, exactly. The next ones that you'll come across are much, much bulkier, much more bulbous, and they're the curvilinear probes. Now, these ones send out a lower frequency sound, and so those you get much better depth penetration. They go really far into the tissues, but you start to get a lower resolution, so the image isn't quite as clear. It's a little bit grainier. It's a little bit harder to interpret. But the spread of the beam out of a curvilinear probe is really wide. So you get a massive kind of wide field of view. So the curvilinear probe is excellent for things like abdominal scans. And you might have heard about FAST scanning, for example. And that's the sort of probe that you'll use for that one. And then the final probe that we're going to use in cardiac arrest and for cardiac imaging is called the phased array. Now, this actually has the lowest frequency. So obviously, that comes with the disadvantage of being the lowest resolution image. So we haven't really got super crystal clear images, but actually, that's okay, because what we want to pick up in cardiac arrest, which we're going to come onto, is much more gross pathology. But with that low frequency, we get a really good depth penetration. And we'll talk about where we're going to place the probe on the chest later on. And that's important. We need that depth from the low frequency phased array probe. Finally, just to mention, if you're using these probes, sort of one of the handheld devices in particular, what you'll often find is you get a dual probe, which are excellent. And depending on the preset that you choose, you will either get to use either a linear probe or the phased array. And it's basically a two-ended transducer. And between those two probes, you can pretty much cover off every view that you want to do, with a couple of limitations, but you'll still be able to kind of get the images that you need.
So I guess the reason that we're really passionate about the idea of using ultrasound in cardiac arrest is that cardiac arrest is that presentation that's got maximally high stakes. You couldn't get somebody any sicker than in cardiac arrest. And actually, the things that we can do traditionally in cardiac arrest, so absolutely excellent advanced life support, making sure we get good chest compressions, early defibrillation, and then going through some of the history and thinking about some of the reversible causes, is actually reasonably limited. But what ultrasounds gives the ability to do is, without really interfering with any of that, get some really useful prognostic information, so we can really try and work out what's the chance of this patient having a good outcome, or actually, are we reaching a point of futility? and identify potential reversible causes, as James alluded to earlier, which we wouldn't necessarily have been able to predict. And we'll go into a bit more detail about which reversible causes we're thinking about. So I guess in order to really understand how useful ultrasound is in arrest, we need to have a little think about the evidence base that underpins it.
So just before we get into that evidence then and start having a think about what the papers are saying out there, let's just paint the picture a little bit by thinking about what sort of patient, what sort of presentation is it that we're looking at, and when are we thinking about pulling that ultrasound out of our bag? James, any suggestions?
So Rob, I've got one, and I think it's a really crucial point, and that is that these ultrasound scans in cardiac arrest should only be undertaken during a non-shockable algorithm. And the reason for that is we know what the optimum treatment is for a shockable cardiac arrest. We know it's high quality CPR and defibrillation, and depending on your interpretation of paramedic two, giving a little bit of adrenaline. But the problem we've got with PEA and asystolic arrests is that actually high quality CPR and adrenaline is kind of like a stopgap until we find the magic bullet, which is the reversible cause that's actually going to get this patient back into a perfusing rhythm. You know, and that's where ultrasound can come in, both for the reversible causes, like we've said, and for prognostication. So I think for now, that's the key message, is this is only for the non-shockable algorithms.
Yeah, I completely agree with you, James. I think that is really important to mention from the outset, that the thing we don't want to interfere with is the fundamental elements of life support. So if you think of the first two chains in our chain of survival, so we've got our early recognition and call for help, we've got our basic life support to buy us time. We cannot let ultrasound interfere with those things. Now, the decision-making process that we have then comes in. The next step is when we get to that rhythm. If they need shocking, then they get a shock. If not, then we need to focus on those reversible causes, like you say, and that is where, for me, ultrasound might have a role.
Yeah, brilliant. And those roles that ultrasound can fulfill within cardiac arrest, like we've said, are prognostication and looking for certain reversible causes. So I reckon it's time to move this episode on. Let's look in this next section at the evidence behind using ultrasound in cardiac arrest to prognosticate patients. Now, personally, I think this is an amazing opportunity to add to our clinical picture, and I do use it in my clinical practice at the moment. But am I right to? Simon Lang, can you support my practice?
Well, try not to at the best of times. But so I think this is really interesting, isn't it? Because what we do, we try and base on sound evidence, and there are some good studies out there to try and gain some real information and some weight on the sorts of things that we can pick out in cardiac arrest using ultrasound. But there are some inherent problems with that, and that will come out as we run through the paper. So probably the best one to start with is from Blythe, and that was from Academic Emergency Medicine in 2012. And that was entitled "Bedside-Focused Echocardiography as a Predictor of Survival in Cardiac Arrest Patients, a Systematic Review." So basically, as you would expect, they're looking at all the best papers that they can find on the use of echo in cardiac arrest. And they found in this systematic review nearly 600 patients who were having echo during their resuscitation. And they were looking for the presence or absence of any cardiac motion whilst they're scanning. And as we'll talk about, that'll be during the rhythm checks. The outcome that they were looking for was return of spontaneous circulation. And I think we can argue whether or not ROSC is actually what you want to be looking for, or good neurological outcome. But at the time, this is the best that we've got. So the key bit that they found was expressed as likelihood ratios. And gosh, do I love a likelihood ratio. So if they found when they were scanning the heart that there was some cardiac activity, that had a positive likelihood ratio for ROSC of just over 4. If they found that there was no activity, then that had a likelihood ratio of 0.18. So a huge variance in the chance of ROSC when you look at cardiac activity or none. Now, what that actually means in real terms is, let's say you've got a 25% chance of getting a ROSC with your patient. A scan which shows that there is some cardiac activity would then mean your chance of ROSC was 50 to 60%, but the negative scan would mean a chance of ROSC is about 5%. And that is, in isolation, a really useful bit of information.
Yeah, that is indeed. That is pretty impressive, isn't it? But I think the thing to bear in mind with that is that you're looking at a study from 2012 there, and a lot of stuff has changed. And I know that we both read this paper that was published in 2019 in Resuscitation, so I won't mock you too much. But this is essentially an updated version of that review. So this was, is POCUS a reliable predictor of outcome in non-shockable medical arrest by Lalande in Resuscitation? And this had 1,500 patients. Now, what they found was they found a positive likelihood ratio had actually increased when you included the studies from 2012 to 2018 to 6.8, and the negative likelihood ratio had again unfortunately climbed a touch, so it was 0.27. but what that is giving us is a really strong signal that actually if your patient has got some cardiac activity, there is a much greater chance of them having a ROS, but it is not something that you can use to rule out a good recovery, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think when we're using this information, we need to be aware, don't we, that there's a huge amount of bias involved in the fact that people will be scanning the heart in the rhythm check. If they see nothing on the ultrasound, then that is a demotivating and, you know, from a common sense perspective, that is a bad thing to see. If they see that the heart's there beating, then that's going to give you some reassurance that it's worth carrying on. However, the figures are so different, I think, with these likelihood ratios that they do give a useful bit of information. And that's obviously then put in the context of, you know, how long the arrest has been going on for, what's going on with the end tidal CO2, what was the rhythm, was there bystander CPR, all the sorts of things that you would normally think about. But this then gives a nice bit of explicit information that we can then use.
I agree with you to a degree on that. I wouldn't say I agree with you 100% on that, because I mean, I think the the problem with it is that, yeah, it gives a really good signal towards that, and I think in practice you're completely right that you know, we've seen this, but I think we do need to take the critical appraisal of meta-analyses like these into consideration. And if you look at the studies that were involved in these meta-analyses, there is so much heterogeneity, there is so many differences between the studies that make up these numbers. So for example, you know, in that study that I've just mentioned by Lalande, you know, 800 of those 1,500 patients came from one study, and the rest were made up from sort of 50 to 100 patient observational studies. And of course, there's this confirmation bias that comes whereby, you know, you don't go on any longer in those patients that don't have cardiac activity because you think they're going to die, you think they're going to do worse, and there is that confirmation bias. But what you need to be aware of, and you need to look into when you're considering what this evidence means for your practice, is, you know, what were these actually looking at? And, you know, they all look at different outcomes. So some of them were looking at ROSC, some of them were looking at 24-hour survival, some survival to hospital admission, some to discharge. They had different definitions of what actually cardiac motion was. I mean, so this is fundamental to what we're looking at. I mean, when you say cardiac motion, Simon, what do you actually mean? And is that the same as what I actually mean? Because in these studies, it was different. So some of them said any movement was cardiac motion. Some of them relied on ventricular wall motion. Some of them said that it was fine to have valves that were flapping around. Some of them, they didn't actually specify what they meant by motion whatsoever. But you need to be quite clear on that, because you might see a little bit of blood swirling in them ventricles. And is that classed as cardiac motion? Well, to me, it's not. But ultimately, I don't know what these studies used, because they don't define it particularly well.
Yeah, that is a fair point, as much as I hate to admit it. And also, the inter-rater reliability is a bit questionable, isn't it? But that being said, I still think there is utility, isn't there, to performing this with a view to prognostication. But we just need to take it with a pinch of salt.
Yeah, man, I'm not a hater. I'm not a hater at all. And I do think there is definite. And, you know, I think for me, this is one of the main things that I find it useful for in practice. But I do think that, you know, you can't go saying this is the be all and end all. And you've already eloquently mentioned about the fact that this feeds into part of the decision making, doesn't it? It's not just about whether there's cardiac motion, whatever that might be in inverted commas. It's about that whole package that you're seeing in front of you. So it's end tidal CO2, it's downtime, it's was a bystander CPR, it's how long was that there for, how long did it take till they got defibrillated, etc. And that's what it all feeds into. It's not a yes no binary decision based on cardiac wall motion. It's simply not that simple. But my goodness, if you incorporate it into your practice as part of the whole picture, yeah, it's super useful.
I think they're all absolutely excellent points there, chaps. Very well debated. Good effort.
Excellent. B minus for the debating team at the research room.
Yeah, I reckon that's good. And I think the other interesting thing to draw out of this is there's a lot of focus on sort of the cardiac activity and how much of a positive prognostic factor that might be. But actually, it's really important to remember, isn't it, that actually not having cardiac activity doesn't mean that you're definitely not going to survive or get a ROSC. So I think you mentioned, Rob, the paper that included 800 patients in it as a prospective observational study. That was the REASON trial, and that found that actually 0.6% of patients, which is a small amount but still is some, 0.6% of patients that had no cardiac activity on ultrasound survived to hospital discharge. So we can't use this as a rule out tool, but I absolutely agree. I think to add to your clinical picture, I think ultrasound is really useful.
What do you think about, just coming back to that, so what do you think about, you mentioned obviously you can't use it as a rule out for ROSC on the basis of that you haven't got cardiac motion. But talk to me about serial examinations and talk to me about time periods, because, you know, there can be no cardiac wall motion at 2 minutes when you do a, you know, your second pulse check. That's fine. I buy that. But if you're 2 hours down the line, you're still resuscitating and there's none, surely it's pretty bad by then, isn't it?
Yeah, an interesting question, Rob. And actually, there's a cool study about this back in 2016 by Kim et al. In resuscitation. And they looked at serial echoes throughout a cardiac arrest rather than just a single assessment of cardiac activity, which is like a lot of the studies do. Some of them look either at one single point in time. Some of them look at the initiation of resuscitation and then at the cessation of resuscitation. But this looked specifically at undertaking serial echoes throughout the cardiac arrest and investigated what value that had. I mean, it's a small study, let's be honest. It was 48 patients that were enrolled. But what they found was that if the patient had cardiac standstill for greater than 10 minutes, then that had a positive predictive value of 100% and a specificity of 100% for a patient not getting a ROSC. So I think you're right. I think taking our prognostication off one scan probably isn't the right way forward. And we've already talked about the fact that actually, you know, what you think is cardiac activity is maybe different to me. And so actually another utility of undertaking serial ultrasounds is that there can be agreement that actually, yes, we're definitely not seeing cardiac activity. And if you had a little question around maybe one of the scans, maybe that would be addressed by the other ones. I think serial echoes is the way forward when we're thinking about prognostication.
But I think that just goes along with the fact that as a cardiac arrest goes on for longer, that the prognosis is less, isn't it? And I think, again, it just plays back to the fact that incorporating these findings is in the context of the arrest, isn't it? And it's using all the information together. Now, whether or not you need to do that serially, if it's going to interrupt how you're running the arrest or how you're using all of the team during the arrest, I think you need to sort of weigh that up on a case-by-case basis, don't you?
Yeah, that's a fair point. That's a fair point.
I think you're right. And we are going to talk very, very specifically about how you integrate ultrasound into your ALS protocol, because it is important that it's a considered part of your ALS guideline rather than just something that you do kind of willy-nilly.
All right, boys. So prognostication, fair enough. We think there's a role for it there. Almost 100% agreement from the team. Or is there 100%? Yeah, probably 100% agreement from the team. Okay. Now, next big one, of course, is talking about our reversible causes, though, isn't it? And identifying those bad boys so that we can get those patients better in quick, smart time. So what's your thoughts on what we should be looking for with ultrasound then? And what sort of role do you think that plays within our cardiac arrest algorithm then?
So I think, like we talked about sort of right back at the beginning of the podcast, the cool thing that we've got with ultrasound is that it gives us that window into the body to see pathology in action. And that means that we can hopefully do our best to rule out a couple of the reversible causes, which historically really we're just guessing at. And those two kind of key reversible causes, I think that there may be some discussion and some argument that there could be others you could look for, but the two classic key reversible causes in cardiac arrest are cardiac tamponade and pulmonary embolus. And like we talked about when we were talking about the different probes that we can use in ultrasound, these are two big pathologies that we can see, and they're quite clear, they're quite obvious to us. We don't need that really crisp, clear image from a high frequency ultrasound probe. We can get that with the low frequency probe. And I guess what we're looking for when we think about the cardiac tamponade is we're looking for a collection of black. So remember, fluid is dark because the ultrasound waves pass through it. So we're looking for black fluid around, surrounding the heart. And that's going to give us some indications that there's a collection of fluid around the heart. Now, not necessarily tamponade physiology, but if you see that in a cardiac arrest, then I think you're going to be concerned. Then when it comes to PE, what we're looking for is dilatation of the right side of the heart. And so you look at the RV, you look at the right ventricle, and what you're probably going to see is a very dilated right ventricle, possibly even with the interventricular septum kind of bowing into the left ventricle. And you're probably going to see a really hyperdynamic, so a very, very active left ventricle, but one which has got very little filling because there's not heaps of blood getting through to it because of the massive pulmonary embolus. But the one hesitation we've got around looking at right-sided dilatation in cardiac arrest for pulmonary embolus is that it's maybe not so specific. And I think Simon might have some evidence that can help us through that minefield.
So I think it's pretty fair to say, isn't it, that people will be echoing patients that are alive and have got a cardiac output to look for signs of PE. And certainly in those patients that are critically unwell and look peri-arrest, then we will be performing echoes to look for signs of RV dilation. But cardiac arrest is a completely different commodity, and we're doing things which we wouldn't be doing in those patients who've got a spontaneous circulation. So they're having chest compressions ongoing. Essentially, when we're doing that, they've got no flow. And I think trying to extrapolate the data from patients who've got a spontaneous circulation to those who are in cardiac arrest is a fundamentally risky thing to do. Now, there was a fantastic podcast from Jacob Avila and from Kian McDermott on the Ultrasound podcast, which talked about this, actually. And the studies that they included and the references in there are really interesting, and I highly recommend that you go and have a listen to that podcast as well as this. But the evidence is limited. The studies that are performed are not all on humans. There are a lot of pigs involved.
Pigs. Bats.
God, it's like a farmyard program, this.
It is. And not a good one.
And what it does show you is that there are multiple other reasons, not just the PE, that will cause you RV dilation. And there are other conditions as well, as it may just be a variant of a normal view during cardiac arrest. So I would be really skeptical about just acting on an echo which shows those features that you'd be looking for with a suspected PE in cardiac arrest, and then translating that to a, we should then be treating the patient for a PE. I think, you know, whether or not you're going to combine this part of the echo with the history that's been taken and very suspicious for a PE, well, that might be a bit different. But just in isolation, I am pretty skeptical about that.
So I completely agree, Simon. And this really is a feature that's flowing all the way through this podcast, isn't it? Ultrasound is amazing, but it's not shouldn't be viewed in isolation. So exactly the same as prognostication, we need to take into account the full clinical picture whilst we interpret the images that we're seeing. You know, we shouldn't just plonk the probe on and then believe that we're seeing right ventricle dilatation and then start pushing TPA and thrombolysis and then committing the patient and the team to a really prolonged resuscitation without actually considering all the other factors around it.
Coming back to that, though, I think there are certain occasions where you might still do that, you know, as in if you've got the right patient with the right history and the right ultrasound, then I think you have got a clinical case there to use TPA. Do you know what I mean? So
I just don't think you need the ultrasound in that context to make that decision.
No, okay, but fair enough. But I mean, I guess if you're in a position where you're where there is a degree of equipoise, or if your cardiac arrest team are, say, a little reluctant, it might add a little bit more weight to your decision making, because as we've alluded to already, these are resource heavy patients, aren't they? You know, when it comes to cardiac arrest management. Yeah, okay, it might not be the deal breaker, but ultimately I think it adds more fuel to the fire, or more weight to the argument.
It might not be the deal maker, mate.
Fair enough. Deal maker, deal break. I don't know. All I'm saying is it might be helpful. It might be helpful. Come on.
Yeah, I agree, Rob. You know, it's another tool in your toolbox. Why wouldn't you use it? And if you're using it appropriately, which we're going to come on to in a second, it's not interrupting your ALS. And why wouldn't you gather extra information to help make a decision?
I think so.
I think it's useful.
I think so. We're going to talk about this in a minute. But, you know, if you've got that resources there on scene, you're building up a picture all the time, aren't you? During your cardiac arrest, you do that anyway. And actually, go on, jump in then with your butts. Come on, let's hear it. Let's hear it.
He's desperate.
But the question is it actually valuable information? It's information, but is it valuable? And I think that the conclusion is, from what's out there, is that it isn't.
Well, all right. I don't know what to say. We disagree.
We are allowed to disagree. I think, but, need to accept the fact I'm right.
I fundamentally disagree with the fact that you're right. That's the point I'm willing to sit on it. I think there are situations. Yes, I think you're completely right. You know what you were talking about here is we're talking about two pathologies. You're talking about diagnostic, really, aren't you, with regard to cardiac arrest, effusion. Plus or minus tamponade, you know, you're not going to know at that point, are you? But if the history fits, then that's something you're going to need to treat, isn't it? Because that's one of your reversible causes. And that's ultimately what we're going looking for here. It's not just about, you know, looking cool, going back into the start.
Yeah, no. So as you will believe, being cool has never been a top goal of mine. You know, you got to set achievable standards. And I think, you know, tamponade is totally different in my mind to looking for this RV dilation, because what, you know, for example, the paper from Combs that looks at only 25 patients in PEA, 14 of them have got a significantly enlarged RV, but PE could only be confirmed in 9 of those cases. So
that's still quite a lot of them.
Yeah, it's good odds. I'll take that.
You'll take that. Listen to him.
Jeez. I tell you what, this is a long pulse check and debate about this ultrasound, isn't it?
I think we can wrap that one up there, can't we? I mean, I think we can agree to disagree. The evidence is inconclusive, and I think it comes down to clinician choice. How about that? I'm going to sit right on the fence.
Yeah, I think so. But just to clarify, I think that, you know, it's definitely not the thing that's going to make your mind, as in that sole factor is not going to be what makes your decision. It's not going to be right ventricular dilatation, they're getting TPA. That's not the fact at all, but it might feed into the clinical picture that you're trying to build up. Simon's argument is that actually it's more about the history and comorbid state, et cetera, which is perfectly reasonable. But yeah, plus or minus ultrasound. But yeah, you're quite right. In isolation, that is not something we're going to be looking to push TPA for.
Simon, while you're on a roll with shooting us down, what about if somebody mentions scanning the lungs in a medical cardiac arrest?
So this was mentioned online, wasn't it, as one of the questions to cover in the podcast. And again, I think this is about, isn't it, the picture in front of you, the information you've got, and what can be added by that ultrasound. Now, ultrasound can obviously be used to gain evidence that there is a pneumothorax, but what you've got in a cardiac arrest is somebody that you're ventilating, and the information that you can derive from your ventilation, you know, from the resistance of squeezing the bag, from the settings on the ventilator, you know, whatever it may be, I think that that is so much more valuable than looking at one little section of a lung, determining whether or not it's up and down. It doesn't tell you what's going on in all those different fields. And the ability to scan, you know, the whole of the lung field to determine whether or not there is a pneumothorax widespread, I just think that this is not the time to be using that. And all the time that you're using ultrasound and cardiac arrest, you need to think about how much that is interfering with what we know makes a big difference. And that is good high quality CPR, short intervals to check that pulse and rhythm, and then getting on with defibrillation as appropriate. So for me, no chance that I'd be scanning the lungs in cardiac arrest.
Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, the key factor here is we're talking about a medical cardiac arrest. We're talking about interrupting the things that we know, or we certainly have strong suspicions to believe that they make a difference in cardiac arrest. And actually, you can use that as part of your post-resuscitation care bundle absolutely fine, can't you? You know, point of care ultrasound is no problems as part of that. But to get in the way of the essentials or the fundamentals is plain wrong. So yeah, I don't think it's going to add a huge amount in most cases.
Great. Well, just before we move on to talk about how we're going to integrate ultrasound into our cardiac arrest protocols, I think it's worth just thinking about whether ultrasound has any utility in traumatic arrests. We talked obviously solely at the moment about medical arrests. And I've often wondered, I think particularly when it comes to the really high stakes interventions like thoracotomy, whether ultrasound should or could be used to give us any sort of, I don't know, prognostic indicators or to hint that we should be undertaking these procedures, because, you know, they're not benign. There's risk to the rescuers, both psychologically and physically. So has anyone got any papers that look at traumatic arrest and ultrasound?
Of course we have. So,
ooh, few.
So this was a paper, wasn't it, from 2015, and it's by Inaba and published in the Annals of Surgery. And essentially, it's looking at two EDs, and it looks at their patients that turned up in traumatic cardiac arrest, had an ultrasound scan, and it enrolled those patients that went on to have a resuscitative thoracotomy. Now, what they found in this is that identifying cardiac motion on this scan was 100% sensitive and 73% specific for identifying either survivors or those that could donate organs. And some people interpreted this as meaning that those essentially that you're considering doing a thoracotomy on, if you put an ultrasound on, then if there's no motion, that may mean that there is no point going on to do a thoracotomy. And you can understand the concerns, because thoracotomy is a high risk procedure. If it's on a futile case, then it is a very invasive thing to do in a futile fashion. However, the number of survivors that they actually had in this paper was only 9 out of this 180 or so pool of patients. And there's no 95% confidence intervals that are talked about in this paper. So again, and I think we're coming back to this a lot in this podcast, to me, what this paper really meant is that if you're considering doing a thoracotomy, then if it doesn't delay things, getting an ultrasound whilst you're doing your HOT algorithm may give you some more prognostic information, but to me, this definitely shouldn't be a binary decision maker. It should be included in the whole package of that patient's assessment, including the duration of their arrest and other factors that we would consider in this patient cohort.
Oh, sorry, did you say something? Right, excellent, boys. So, I mean, what we need to be thinking about now, though, is how on earth is this ultrasound going to fit into our ALS algorithm and our cardiac arrest management? Well, if you have a look at the Advanced Life Support Guidance, you will find that they don't really talk or emphasize the use of ultrasound that much, to be perfectly honest with you. So it's not something that the Resuscitation Council is pushing massively, I wouldn't say, was my impression when I reread the guidance prior to this episode. But it's certainly, as we've already alluded to, something that we're seeing a lot in practice. And we're using a lot in practice. So, as we've already mentioned, the key in cardiac arrest is to provide effective CPR, early defibrillation for shockable rhythms. Now, anything that interferes with that is going to be bad for patient outcomes. So strip ultrasound away, okay? It is not relevant until we have got those things in place. However, as we've mentioned, if your patient has a non-shockable rhythm, then after initiation of CPR, there are a few actions you need to take. So you need to take stock of where you are on that algorithm. You need to make sure you have an adequate team around you. You need to make sure those fundamentals, those essentials of life support are underway. Okay, those are the key elements that we need to make sure are in place before we start to do anything else. Now, I would argue actually the very next bit is that we need to make sure we've got effective team leadership. We need to make sure that team knows what's happening. They know the next steps. Okay, and this is really useful to maximize your management of that arrest. But then, of course, this is the point where we've got a well-established cardiac arrest team. Okay, now that might take, you know, 10 seconds or it might take a couple of minutes to get that set up, but that's what we need to do before we start thinking about other things. Now, boys, at what point in all of this is ultrasound going to start coming into our game?
Well, Rob, I think you've already described it really well. I mean, I think you don't want to rush into it. I totally agree. And I guess the way I have it in my mind is that I think you need to have that ALS rhythm underway. And so everything is already established. You've got your leader, you've got your advanced airway in place, you've got your IV access, and the arrest is now starting to feel comfortable. And now you're starting to think, right, where are we going from here? What are the reversible causes? As you would in any other arrest. And that is when I think the time is to crack out the ultrasound. Now, there's heaps and heaps of different decisions to be made around how you do this exactly. I think one of the key ones we talked about a lot, and we're not going to beat the drum any further, but you have to make this a considered application. So this should not prolong your pulse checks. It should be undertaken during a pulse check. There's no reason for your ultrasound scan to take any longer than the recommended 10 seconds.
So I think this doesn't even need to be a question, does it? So this is about getting the probe in the right position. We'll talk about that in a second, but getting the probe in the right position, getting ready to scan, getting the countdown to the pause, and then the team leader essentially determines when CPR starts again. So this isn't for the sonographer to be aware of the time that they're taking. This is all about, you know, quick and directive team leadership recommencing CPR. And if you haven't got the images that you need, then you'll be getting another chance in a couple of minutes.
But that's a key point. So if you read the literature out there, okay, so all of the literature in the papers say that it delays pulse checks, okay? So, I mean, you know, they're small studies. So Clattenburg, 2018, they found that actually if you include a protocol, then it will improve your pulse check time from 18 seconds down to 15 seconds when using ultrasound, okay? And, you know, so what they're talking about is they're talking prolongation, but I'm with you on this. And I think that we've got better at it. So these are historical papers. So like from 2010 to 2018 that have looked at this. And I think that we've got better systems. We're more used to using ultrasound and cardiac arrest now. We're more used to actually getting those images done quickly and during pulse checks. And as team leaders, I hope, although maybe these guys that were in this study thought that they were doing it in good time as well, that we're better at spotting when it's going over that 10 seconds. So I'm with you. I think that in contemporary emergency care, I don't think this should prolong or does prolong pulse checks. But you do need to be aware that there is the potential for it to do so. Is that a fair point?
It is. And I think the big question then is how we do that. How do we make sure? One of the ways, obviously, like Simon says, is that we need somebody, a team leader, who is counting down from 10 seconds and gets you off the chest. That's all well and good. But if you haven't got the ultrasound image that you want, and then you just kind of keep repeating the same problem over and over again, you're never going to get your ultrasound image. So how do we do it within 10 seconds? I think I've got a few ideas and a few things that I do, and I'm happy to hear from you guys as well as to what you do. But I mean, I think first of all, we need to have a sonographer or someone who is using the ultrasound who isn't the team leader. We've already said that the leader needs to be in charge of the arrest and of timing. So someone's allocated as the person to do the scan. Then they're going to find the machine. They're going to switch it on. If you've not used one of these machines before, they take flipping ages to turn on. So it's not great if they say, right, okay, ready for the pulse check, and you're just turning the machine on, because by the time it's ready, you'll be well into the next cycle of resuscitation.
It's like a 10-year-old laptop, mate. 10-year-old
yeah,
laptop.
It is. It's like
switch on, make a cup of tea.
Yes,
DOS retro. Love it.
Get your ultrasound machine turned on, get the gel on the probe, and then get yourself positioned on the patient. I don't really mind where you are, so long as you're not in the way of people. Personally, I like to come in from the patient's right-hand side, so I'm using my dominant hand, but some people like to come in from the left. But get yourself in position. And then you can also get your probe on the chest if you want to. Now, this is important. There are a number of different places that you can obtain cardiac views from. The most common one used in cardiac arrest is the subxiphoid view. And that's exactly as it says on the tin. You're putting the probe just at the bottom of the sternum, on the kind of the fleshy bit of your abdomen. And you're kind of pushing down and almost scooping the ultrasound probe underneath the ribs and underneath the sternum to kind of fire the ultrasound beam up towards the heart. And you can kind of have that in place ready for when the cardiac arrest team leader calls time for a pulse check. And then when they do that, you should be getting a view within a second or two. And then the next kind of key point, I think, is that you shouldn't be analyzing the ultrasound image during that pulse check. As soon as you get the ultrasound image that you want, you need to press save on your ultrasound machine, which is then going to save, depending on your settings, a little video of between 3 and 5 seconds. You can then come off the chest and you've got all the time in the world then to sit with the team leader, if necessary, or with another colleague and interpret that image, looking for cardiac motion, signs of right dilatation, if you're keen on it, and cardiac tamponade. So I think probably they're my thoughts for how to make that as slick as possible. I don't know if you boys have got any other thoughts.
I think exactly that, plus the fact that you need to make sure that you get that gel off as soon as you've done it. So either yourself or one of your team members needs to wipe that off straight away. And that's for two reasons. One, it looks like you're doing CPR on a slippery fish, or that you're worried about how your Lucas cup is going to sit on the patient's chest when you go on to carry on doing CPR. Or two, if you need to change your pad placement, then it can cause an absolute disaster, can't it? So you need to think about the potential implications for leaving a slippery chest after you've done your bit of fancy ultrasound.
I'm slightly concerned about your hand position and the position of your defibrillation pads, mate. We're talking sub-xiphoid here.
If he's ever, I will give you 100 quid if he's ever put a pair of pads on a patient. It's definitely someone else who does that.
Or done CPR.
He wouldn't know where they go. He thinks patients have them already attached to them.
If you think that gel doesn't slip around that chest, you've got another thing coming.
You've seen people. You've never done chest compressions.
Too posh to push, mate.
There you go. Yeah.
All right. So let's have a bit of decorum here. So I think final point before we try and reach desperately for a conclusion to this episode is that throughout this podcast, we've been talking about transthoracic echo. Now, there is something else called transesophageal echo. Now, that has not quite reached pre-hospital realm yet, but you may find it being used in hospital. And it does have some pretty cool opportunities, which are just being investigated at the moment, such as real-time maneuver of the person doing the chest compressions, moving their hands so that you're optimally compressing the LV during resuscitation. Now, this is some pretty new, pretty innovative stuff, but I think keep an eye on it because it's pretty amazing and it may change the face of resuscitation in the future.
Excellent. Right, so that is ultrasound in cardiac arrest. So, in summary, we've talked a little bit about how ultrasound works, the sorts of probes you'll be selecting and the reason why, along with the sort of pictures that you'll get on ultrasound when thinking about the sorts of tissues that you're looking at. We've then had a think about the utility of ultrasound in cardiac arrest and seen not only can it be used for prognostication, but actually to identify some reversible causes. Without a doubt, it can be used to identify tamponades, and there's some debate about whether or not we should be using it to look for signs of a pulmonary embolus, but we won't revisit that debate now. When it comes to traumatic arrest, again, there's a bit of a debate about whether or not it should be used for a binary decision maker to whether or not we should proceed to thoracotomy in our patients with that traumatic arrest. And then finally, we've had a think about the integration of cardiac ultrasound in arrest. And I think the key message from this is that if you're going to do it, it needs to be done in a coordinated fashion. It needs to be done with great team leadership. It can be done to gain some extra information that you can then revisit from your clip that you've saved whilst the resuscitation is ongoing. But just make sure that it doesn't come at the sacrifice of any other parts of your resuscitation. A big thanks once again to SJ Trem for supporting the podcast. Go over and have a look at their free open access journal online. So that's it from us. Take care of yourselves and we will speak to you soon.